This is Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
On March 11, 2024, a few months before the Lok Sabha elections, the central government notified the Citizenship Amendment Rules. This has come approximately 4 years after the Parliament passed the Citizenship Amendment Act in 2019. As per the amendment, the government can grant citizenship to Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Parsis, Jains, or Christians from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan on or before December 31, 2014, conspicuously leaving out Muslims. It was passed amid nationwide protests as linking citizenship to religion goes against the secular nature of the constitution. The bigger fear is about a nationwide National Register of Citizens or NRC. Assam is the only place with NRC. At the time of passing the act, the Home Minister Amit Shah told Parliament that a nationwide NRC is on the cards. However, in a blog post, Press Information Bureau at the time clarified repeatedly that no announcement has been made to begin NRC exercise.
Manyavar, main is sadan ko phir se ek baar aashwast karna chahta hun. Jab hum NRC lekar aayenge, ek bhi ghuspaithiya is desh ke andar bach nahi jayega. Kisi ko chinta karne ki zarurat nahi. Main bade adhikar ke saath kehta hun. Manyavar, ओवैसी साहब ने अभी कहा कि एनआरसी का बैकग्राउंड बना रहे हैं. एनआरसी का कोई बैकग्राउंड बनाने की जरूरत नहीं है. हम इस पर बिल्कुल साफ है कि इस देश में एनआरसी होकर रहे.
इन द ब्लॉग पोस्ट द प्रेस इंफॉर्मेशन ब्यूरो सेड दैट देयर इज नो अनाउंसमेंट टू इंप्लीमेंट एनआरसी ऑल ओवर इंडिया. इट सेज दिस एंड आई एम कोटिंग, if it is implemented, it does not mean that anyone will be asked for proof of being Indian. NRC is merely a normal process to register your name in the citizens register. Just like we present our identity cards or any other document for registering our names in the voter list or getting Aadhaar card made, similar documents shall need to be provided for NRC as and when it is carried out. Now, with the rules being released, nationwide implementation of the Act will begin. In 2019, the United Nations Human Rights Office issued a statement condemning the quote-unquote fundamentally discriminatory Citizenship Amendment Act. At the time in 2019, Suno India's Padma Priya had spoken to Pia Oberoi, Senior Advisor on Migration, UN Human Rights Office, to understand their concerns about the Citizenship Amendment Act. We are republishing it as it continues to be relevant today.
Pia, your office recently issued a press release saying that the Citizenship Amendment Act, which was ratified by the Indian Parliament, was fundamentally discriminatory in nature. Could you please explain to our listeners why that is?
We expressed a concern that the Act was fundamentally discriminatory because of the consequences that it could have on particular groups. We fully applaud and welcome the intention of the Indian government to establish a framework of protection for people that are being persecuted. And indeed, we've, as well as human rights mechanisms, have asked for a number of years that a robust national asylum system should be put into place to include people that are fleeing harm, persecution, conflict, human rights violations, for all the recognized grounds. Our concern is that by only picking out not just certain countries, but within them only particular groups or religiously defined groups, there's a strong element of discrimination. We're concerned that, for instance, Muslim people of Muslim origin that are fleeing from these countries will not be considered to have suffered persecution and will be prevented from accessing the benefits of the regularization of the amnesty provisions of this Act. Should there be really a concern to protect people that are fleeing persecution and violation, one could very easily imagine a national asylum system which puts in place non-discriminatory grounds of protection for all people that flee certain kinds of harm. And it's important that India does so to avoid these charges of discrimination.
Your press release further states also that the amended law appears to undermine the commitment to equality before law. one enshrined in the Indian Constitution, but also under different international covenants. Could you perhaps tell our listeners a bit more about these international covenants and which part is India party of and what has it not signed?
Certainly. International human rights law, right from the founding of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, protects all people on the basis of their humanity, on the basis of their fundamental humanness. So we have a number of core international human rights instruments, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in fact, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights as well, and the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which covers discrimination on religious grounds. Now, India is a party to all of these instruments, as well as having strong constitutional provisions to protect the fact that all people within its jurisdiction have certain fundamental rights which cannot be legislated away, if you will. And this is important because it means that we can ensure that all people have a certain level of protection, not because they come into the country with a particular visa, not because they have a particular passport or because they profess a certain religion, but because on the basis of the common humanity that we all share, India is obliged to provide them protection. So this is the fundamental basis on which human rights protection and the fundamental principle of non-discrimination operate. In addition, we have protections within international human rights law to protect, on the one hand, refugees, such as the 1951 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol, as well as on the other protections for migrant workers and members of their families within the International Convention on Migrant Workers. Unfortunately, India has not ratified either of these two important conventions, and we would very much, you know, call the Indian government to look seriously and consider seriously ratification. But even without that ratification, as I said, international human rights law, the core instruments that India has already ratified, call on the country to look seriously and with a non-discriminatory lens at all people on the move. We've seen that people move for different reasons and often very individual reasons for protection as they move. We also don't insist, we don't believe that every country must open its doors to everybody that is on the move. International law fundamentally respects the principle of sovereignty. It is up to a government to decide who it wants to welcome into its country. But there's important caveats to that. One is that, for instance, you cannot render a person stateless in deciding to withdraw your citizenship from the person. So you have to investigate whether by withdrawing your citizenship, this person would face harm and human rights violation. And the second is international community over the last 2 or 3 years has realized that there needs to be a fundamental rethink about how people on the move are being governed. And this is not just related to India or to South Asia, but to really the whole world. We've seen big, complex movements of people in Europe, in the Americas, where the international community has decided to really think about what we need to do to cooperate better to provide protection to people. So on the one hand, we have had a process of development of a global compact on refugees, which India has been part of. And secondly, we've had the adoption in December 2018 of a global compact for safe, orderly, and regular migration, again, which India endorsed. And taken together, these two frameworks really provide a roadmap for countries and for regions to come together to put in place protections for people on the move, and to govern migration in a way that is fair for the communities into which they come, as well as for those people on the move themselves.
Thank you so much, Pia. So at one side, the Indian government is saying that the new Citizenship Amendment Act provides refuge to persecuted minorities from 3 different countries. But at the same side, you have national leaders also talking about illegal immigrants. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners how your office views these terminology, like, you know, a refugee versus an illegal immigrant? Because I know that there's a lot of conversation around even the usage of this terminology. And how should one view this conversation now? Because if I'm hearing you right, at the end of the day, refugees should be provided on the basis of need, right? I mean, as per the humanitarian principles, it's on the basis of, you know, and every individual has a reason for seeking refuge. But on the other side, there is this whole conversation about illegal immigration happening from the different South Asian countries into India. So how should one look at this conversation now? Like, even in terms of whether it's media reportage or even the conversations that are happening, the conversation seems to be leading towards, oh, well, these are illegal immigrants. They need to be put inside detention centers. They should not be inside the country, or they should be kicked out of the country. How do we balance this conversation?
No, it's a very important question. And, you know, again, just to put it in context, these are conversations that are happening in many countries, in South Asia, in Asia Pacific, in Europe. You know, I mean, these are very fundamental conversations that are happening in many countries. Let's just take the example of the Citizenship Amendment Act, for instance, which says that it wants to provide protection to religious minorities from three specific countries. This would be fine if it was being placed within the framework of a broader non-discriminatory system that said everybody that came into a country seeking protection from various harms, from various persecution or conflict or human rights harms, is entitled to apply for that protection. Because once you have a situation where you're only singling out particular people from particular countries, you start to become, you know, kind of less convinced that this is about putting in place a broad umbrella of protection. The issue about terminology is important. We have, and in fact, the General Assembly, way back in 1975, basically called on countries not to use the term illegal migrant, precisely because a person cannot be illegal. I mean, their administrative status may be illegal at one point or the other. Again, it comes back to this issue of dehumanization, of rhetoric, kind of putting people into this idea that they are illegal, that they are somehow criminal for the fact that they lack a valid paper, and the kinds of assumptions that are then made about the character and the criminality of people that lack these papers is of great concern to the international community and to human rights mechanisms and to my office. What we would prefer is if the terminology was used of migrants in irregular situations to indicate that their administrative situation is irregular at one point. It may very well change. And this is the point, is that people on the move are often in very complex circumstances. And we completely understand that some people enter countries irregularly. Sometimes they enter countries irregularly because they have no legal way to come into that country. But there may be very valid reasons for them to enter, such as to seek asylum. Another very valid reason to enter, maybe to reunify with family. And I should say that there's many Indians on the move in many parts of the world that do move irregularly for instance, family reunification reasons. We also see that people move irregularly initially and then through a process of administrative regularization or amnesty are able to acquire a regular condition situation. So mixing the fact that, you know, the ways in how people move are complex and administratively often very intricate, with kind of ascribing then to that irregular movement personal failing or a criminality of character or a dangerousness of intent, is, I think, very, very worrying. And if you mix that with a communal character, with saying, well, certain religious groups are excluded because certain religious groups are fundamentally dangerous to our societies, you start going down a road where you can see discrimination to an extent which will ultimately lead to harm and violence towards people.
From your experience of having worked in this field of migration through your office, tell us some of the reasons why people within South Asia move. Like, for example, you have the Rohingyas who are, say, fleeing persecution. Then, you know, you have other conflict situations. So perhaps could you just throw a bit of light in terms of what are some of the reasons for this irregular migration that happens?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, you said yourself, so we have people that are fleeing kind of broad-based persecution based on prohibited grounds, such as the Rohingya. sleep, persecution, feeling kind of statelessness. There's a big and growing concern about people that are forced to flee because of climate and environmental reasons. And I mean, we can think about, for instance, the Pacific, where you have not just concern about livelihoods, but really an existential concern about whether their islands will continue to exist given the rates of climate change. So you have people on the move who are fleeing complex combinations of poverty and disenfranchisement related to conflict reasons. You have people that are fleeing political persecution. And this might not be big groups of people. I mean, India, for instance, has seen large groups of Tibetans that have entered the country, and Tamils from Sri Lanka, Afghan refugees, for a number of years, and has provided to a large extent relatively stable refuge to people. This is why we believe that it would be important to have a system that considers, in the individual case, reasons for why people are moving and to provide protection accordingly. The Global Compact for Migration is interesting because it talks about migrants in situations of vulnerability, and it asks governments to consider the reasons why these people might be vulnerable, and including in that are issues around environmental degradation and the climate, but also lack of access to human rights, such as the right to food or the right to health, and calls on governments to put in place measures where they can assess the reasons, they can screen people for why they are in these situations of vulnerability. The Asia-Pacific region is home to a number of people moving for reasons of political persecution, of social unrest and upheaval, and climate and environmental degradation.
You also talk about in the press release about a national asylum framework. Are there any countries, you know, within South Asia or even broader, which actually have a good and working national asylum framework? Because if I even look at, say, the United States, which is now looking at refugees as illegal, are there actually any countries where this is working? I mean, with a very, very robust asylum framework?
Yes, the answer is yes and no, in the sense that there are countries in many parts of the world that have strong kind of legal frameworks of protection. And we can think about Europe, we can think about, for instance, Thailand, which is at the moment putting in place a screening mechanism to provide protection to people fleeing persecution and human rights violations. So there are a number of countries around the world which have taken kind of meaningful steps that have established very precise and fair asylum procedures. The concern is that enough resources are put to such a system. Such a system is not undermined by political considerations. And this is where having an asylum system that is built into a legal framework of protection is important, so that any kind of elements of discrimination or inequity and inequality can be challenged before the law. So there are good practice examples around the world. There's also concerns that once the whole issue of immigration and asylum becomes politically weaponized, that the frameworks of protection are not allowed to kind of then fall sway to the political considerations. Because as India has seen, and as many countries have seen, the issue of who we get to say is part of our society is something that can and has been very successfully weaponized by populist leaders, by populist media, by other public figures, for all sorts of reasons. Electoral gains being one. We have concerns, for instance, that hate of foreigners is a good way to sell newspapers, for instance, and we're working with groups that try to push back against media outlets that profit from the kind of the selling of hate. So the issue about what kind of asylum and immigration systems should be put in place is not just a technocratic one for governments. It's one for every one of us as members of society to consider what kind of societies we want to live in, what kinds of societies we want our children to live in, and then to insist to our governments that those are the kinds of societies that should be built that provide protection for people on the move, and not to divide people into those that seem to be deserving or undeserving of rights. While we can say that there are certain groups of migrants, such as refugees, that need particular protection, it doesn't follow from that that those people that don't need the protection of asylum law, such as other migrants or even migrants in irregular situations, are therefore undeserving of rights. And I think this is where the conversation needs to evolve from saying, well, we're only going to protect a certain group of people that we call refugees, and for the rest, we are completely happy with indefinite detention, collective expulsions, and other human rights violations, because human rights law doesn't agree with the idea that even if you're not a refugee, you then somehow fall into a category of being completely banished from the norms of protection.
How is your office viewing this ongoing concerns about India building detention centers? Though it's being categorically denied by the government, there are still reports coming out by journalists and by other organizations that there are detention centers being built in other parts of the country. How is your office viewing these developments and also the ongoing protests? How are you viewing these things?
You know, we wait to see what the reality is in relation to the actual detention centers. But I do want to say that while a country and a government is entirely within its sovereign entitlement to detain people who may not have the right to remain in a country, there are strong protections that are, for instance, provided through the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which India is a state party, for such detention. Bearing in mind that the detention of a person for immigration reasons does not mean that that person is a criminal in the ordinary sense of the word. They have either overstayed a visa or they've entered a country without the necessary papers, but they haven't committed a crime against a person or property, or even a crime against national security just by crossing a border irregularly. So we would call on the authorities, should there be the contemplation of immigration detention, that this detention is not arbitrary, that it pays particular attention to groups in situations of vulnerability, such as families and children, for instance, or women at risk, so that we're not going to end up in a situation where there is a mass violation of human rights as large amounts of people are put into detention centers. And also, if there is no prospect that they will in fact be returned to the country that the government claims they're from, their detention would turn into prolonged and indefinite and therefore arbitrary. So there's a number of concerns that could arise around the whole issue of immigration detention. In terms of the protests, we've already expressed concern and called for restraint to ensure that people are entitled to their right to freedom of expression, to the ability to protest peacefully their political and other views, and to ensure that any allegations of disproportionate use of force or violence by the authorities is properly investigated and prosecuted.
Say tomorrow in a couple of weeks or months, because there is also the talk of the nationwide National Registry of Citizens and the NPR that is going to be rolled out. Say through that, the fears are, and the fears don't seem very unfounded, frankly. The fears are that even if 1% of the population of 1.3 billion people get affected and they are put in detention centers, and this, like you said, if it turns arbitrary, I think there are a lot of fears from so-called liberal people, as a lot of us are being dubbed, you know, that, oh, well, you know, this might go the China Uyghur Muslim ways. Is there anything that the international community can actually do to put pressure on India in case these detentions turn arbitrary?
No, I mean, and I think, you know, we've all been kind of following the different trajectories that this situation can take. And as you say, one of the concerns could be, and again, and I want to be clear that from our perspective, we're talking about what is happening at the moment, but also we do have an eye on the possibilities that could arise, such as through the extension of the National Register for Citizens. The main concern that we have is of the discriminatory, that there should be no discriminatory application of protection or denial of protection, so that where there is a process of determining a person to be a citizen or not a citizen, that these processes are applied in a non-discriminatory way and that the result doesn't itself kind of cause human rights harm. One of the concerns that there is a real prospect of statelessness. What we would ask is that, you know, that there's a very strong kind of attention paid to the risk of statelessness. And if we come back to the issue of detention, that we don't end in a situation where a mass detention infrastructure is created when there is no prospect of release or return. You know, we have to be kind of aware of why and how the right to liberty can be removed from a person. It's a very fundamental right. It is included in, again, in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the right to liberty, and it applies to everybody. So removing that right from somebody should not be done lightly, and there should be due process structures put in place, such as judicial review, the right to appeal, access to legal counsel, etc., to ensure that we're not going to enter a situation where a large amount of people are placed in detention for arbitrary reasons where they are not able to challenge their detention and where there's no reasonable prospect of them actually being returned. So yes, we're aware that there might be, you know, further ramifications for this process to play out. We don't believe that we're at that situation now. So we are addressing our concerns to the specific issue of the citizenship provision and the discriminatory nature of the regularization at this point.
Thank you.